Accession number 30284, Reel 10.
When is it? Reel 10.
Well, as I say, the circumstances in Southern Rhodesia were very favourable because I had leaves. I went to Victoria Falls. I used to go out at the weekends in my old car with another chap to stay with a farmer who had a tobacco farm near the Hunyani River. We saw the crocodiles, all the wildlife, and so on. I learnt a lot about those circumstances. Then, in addition, I went down on holiday to see my South African relatives. My uncle, who had an MC from the First World War, and also had another decoration which he was rather proud of. It was called a VD, which means a Victoria decoration. That was higher than his. He was very proud of his VD, which came in front of his MC, actually. He was had become a colonel, and we got on extremely well. So I did spend some leaves down there, some leaves in Southern Rhodesia itself. On one occasion, too, I had to, a whole flight of Harvards had to go on a goodwill tour of Northern Rhodesia, together with our chief flying instructor, who was a wing commander, Ogle, and I had to navigate I think there were about nine of us in the Harvards flying around Northern Rhodesia and all the various places there and being welcomed by everybody. Well, there's one other episode there which may be worth mentioning. There was another station, I can't remember which one it was, Heaney, was it Heaney? But anyway, an Anson took off from there, and the navigator made a mistake, and he did what he did, put red on black on his compass. Now, in those days, there was these grid wires, and you had to rotate the grid and put, so north was on north. He put south was on north, and they flew in a reciprocal direction, and they flew way down until they came into Bechuana land. He was supposed to go north, but he went south into Bechuana land, and they ran out of fuel and made a forced landing. And they met some bushmen there. And the bushmen, it was very wild in that country at the time, thought they were police spies. And one night when they were asleep, they killed them. And the bushmen were tried. I think they had to go through about five or six languages to get at them to find out what the hell they were talking about. But they thought they were police spies, or some sort of spies, but something wrong about these chaps who come to do them harm. I don't know what they did with the bushmen, but there was this question of putting red on black, as we called it. And I decided that it would be advisable to alter the grid ring to a T-shaped, so that there's just the north side and the others went east and west. And this was generally adopted in the Air Force after that. And I got an inventor's award of £10 for doing that, which was quite a lot of money in those days. So that was probably the most productive thing I ever did in the Air Force, to change the P4 compass or P6 compass to a grid ring status, to a T-shape instead of a straightforward status. So it was adopted throughout the Air Force, but I don't suppose it's used now at all.
How did you come to leave Rhodesia?
Well, I was together with another friend of mine who was in the navigation section and now lives nearby. In fact, that's his granddaughter who just phoned me. He and I were posted down to Cape Town. My friend was about to get married, and he was meeting his fiancée down there. And we got down to Cape Town, went by train all the way down, took some days to get there, I think. Anyway, when we were there, we were billeted in fairly comfortable circumstances, but we were supposed to get on a boat, and there were no boats at all. We were there for several months waiting to get home. I was itching to get home. Finally, I was apportioned to a boat for once without any admin functions. And it was the Andes, it's called the SS Andes. And it wasn't in convoy. I think by that time we had conquered the U-boat menace, and we had, and this was sailing solo. And the journey was only something like 2.5 weeks to get there. It went like a bat out of hell, this thing. It was rolling about from side to side all the time, going at full speed. And in fact, one or two chaps sort of broke their limbs with this thing rolling about, because it was travelling at a much greater speed than normally would be the case. And I remember they had a tannoy, and there was a song called Somebody's Rocking My Dream Boat going on. So we got in eventually. I had, meanwhile, because South Africa is still a land of plenty, I stocked an entire kit bag full of food, tin food, and arrived home with this kit bag over my shoulder for obviously embarkation leave. Fortunately, the dog still recognised me. My mother, I telephoned saying I'm on my way. My mother's watching for me. She opened the door. I tipped out this kit bag full of food all over the kitchen floor. She looked at it with utter amazement, because I mean, she'd been enduring rationing for God knows how long, and all these tin stuff, quite a heavy lot.
What were your impressions of England coming back after all that time abroad? Was it?
Well, I wanted to join a squadron, but things were... I was sent to some centre or another to find out what I wanted to do. And it was obvious at that time that the European war was coming to an end. And so I said, well, I'd like to join a squadron out in Burma. And so they said, OK, but you better go on a long-range course. And that's what I did.
What did that entail?
Long-range navigation, mostly astro-navigation.
Is there another portion to long-range navigation that differ from the navigation that you described earlier in the
This was ultra-long-range navigation, I suppose you'd call it. We were going to be on Dakotas, and I was going to join a squadron on what's called the Hump Run, over from Calcutta to Kunming. A very, very dangerous business, you know, with the cumulonimbus clouds could literally tear the aircraft apart. But I wasn't going to fly with anybody I didn't feel suitable as being a pilot. And there was an ex-squadron leader pilot turned up on the same course, Jimmy Higgins, who'd gone down to flight lieutenant. He'd done his operational tour beforehand, a wireless operator who'd done his operational tour, and the three of us crewed up and went through this long, long course. It was a heck of a long course on Dakotas, flying. We went up to Crosby on Eden, near Carlisle. And all atrocious weather all the time. But meanwhile, VE Day occurred, of course, so we realised that, you know, what we were doing was necessary for the remainder of the war. We didn't know anything at all about the end of the war, anything about atom bombs or anything like that. We thought that maybe 2 years ahead of us was flying in the Japanese or Pacific theatre. And we got through this course. The wireless operator came top of his course. Jimmy didn't, oddly enough, but I did. We were the top crew coming through. But just before we were due to leave, the atom bombs were dropped. We thought that perhaps we would be disbanded, but we weren't. We were told we still had to go out there.
What was the reason for the length of the course? Was there a reason?
Not as far as I was concerned, because I was only learning things I already knew. But I had to go through them all the same. But I found the course quite simple, and there was very little I learnt which I didn't already know. The only thing I did have was a great deal of practice in the air with night flying with navigation, astro-navigation. Had a Mark 9 A6, and it did improve my skills on that facet of things.
What about the Dakota as an aircraft? Can you again give me a description of that as an aircraft?
Oh, that was a lovely aircraft to fly. It wasn't very fast, it had no armament, but it was highly reliable and very, very roomy, of course. I mean, it was there to carry crate or passengers and troops. And its serviceability rate was extremely high. It was almost without fault, I think. It was known as the Dakota by the British particularly, but I think the Americans called it other things like the Goonie Bird and things like that. But it was a lovely aircraft. It fly on one engine, it could fly high and all that sort of thing. And I still thought that if I got out to Burma, I could somehow transfer onto a light bomber squadron and do my stuff there. But in fact, what happened was that we were told we still had to go there, but we didn't go out by Dakota. We were put in a clapped-out old Stirling with another crew. And this thing took off, and its engine failed, of course, on takeoff. They were looking around, the other passengers had been transferred to the Stirling had been transferred to a passenger role. And I think there were about six of us passengers in there. I looked around, all their faces had gone white. I remember that on this takeoff. But we landed okay. And eventually we took off. It was rectified and we took off and we flew to Maison Blanc, I think, in Algeria. And it went US again. And then we went to Lida and it went US there. And eventually we got across to, I think, Pune or somewhere, and then across to Dum Dum in Calcutta, and stages of this thing going US all the time.
What was it like to be a passenger in a Stirling?
Horrible. Horrible. I hated it. You couldn't do anything about it. It was a horrible, terrible trip I'd ever made. It wasn't just a worn-out old Stirling converted into a passenger role. It was very, very dangerous, I think, this thing. It was always going wrong. There was always something wrong with the engines.
What facilities did you have on board?
Nothing. Those trips were fairly short. I don't think we had... Oh, we might have had some sort of K-rations or something like that to eat, I don't know. But I can't remember. But the trips were fairly short, and we kept being held up all the time we were there. Throughout the trip, it seemed to take days to get to Calcutta. Anyway, we did arrive in Calcutta and Dum Dum, but they had the Kunming routes had been scrubbed because the war was over, and what we were doing was flying around Southeast Asia and Hong Kong and down to Singapore.
In what role were you doing that?
Well, a chap called Peter Humphrey Baker was the squadron navigation officer, and he's already there. So we became quite good friends. I still am friendly with him. He lives in Canada, although he's British. In fact, we went by car across much of Europe after the war. I had a car at home. I've been out to Canada to visit him and his wife and so on. He was an experienced chap. He had a very amusing story to tell me, and he was, I forget what aircraft he was in, but he was with his pilot, and he was shot down over Denmark, but managed to get across into Sweden with his, he was the squadron navigation officer, was flying with the CO, and they were taken into custody, the two of them. And they got to Stockholm, and the CO said, he said, shall we make a break for it? And Peter said yes, and they broke away from their captors and ran like hell. And actually, I read about this in the National Archives afterwards, because the CO said, I jumped over a wire fence, and then realized underneath me was a canal. They fished him out of the canal, and they caught Peter. And they said, why did you do that? And they said, we want to go to the British Embassy. And they said, well, that's where we were taking you in the first place. So Peter and I, sorry.
What was the squadron, though? How was the squadron organised?
Well, it was organised with a very agreeable CO, and we were mostly carrying freight out to these outlying districts. The war was just over, and we were carrying passengers back to Dum Dum, who were being repatriated. They asked me to stay on for 6 months, which I did. And we were quite busy. I think I made over 100 flights in these Dakotas. We would go so far. We went to usually go to Mike Teeler in Burma, and down to Mingledon, across to what was it called, Don Maung in Bangkok, near Bangkok, and then across to Tan Son Nhut, I think it was, in French Indochina, as it was called, and then up to Kai Tak in Hong Kong and back again. Serviceability was pretty good, and circumstances were pretty good there, I think. Sometimes way down to Singapore, I forget the name of the airfield there. Longest sort of trips, and most of the time we were away from Calcutta.
Where did you sit in the aircraft?
I sat behind the pilot. I could sit with the pilot and take in a co-pilot seat. I sat behind him and navigated. And there was a lot of night navigation, I can remember. On one occasion, I had to go to Pigou. And we'd come back all the way from, I don't know, French Indochina or somewhere. And there was, I had to navigate by Astro all the way. And Pigou was right in the middle of the jungle, you know, and I was a bit wondered about where it was, and you know, whether my navigation was going to be correct. And fortunately, it came up right in front of us, and I landed. And I said to Jimmy Higgins, "Oh, that was a bit of relief." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you know, astronav all the way." He said, "Well, that's your bloody job, isn't it?" I didn't get any praise for finding this place in the middle of the jungle. But yes, it was astro-navigation, a lot of astro-navigation there, flying at day and night.
Was there any climatic or weather conditions that would affect your navigation?
Well, there were some monsoon conditions, yes, which there was a southwest monsoon, which could be dangerous. But we seem to get through those all right in this aircraft anyway.
Would there be a procedure in those kind of conditions that you would follow
Well, we had, of course, a wireless operator, and I think he had some sort of equipment which guided us in, but I'd never used it. But for the most part, we flew in daylight, and we flew in reasonable conditions, but the weather could clamp. It could be bad at Hong Kong, too. You know, the sea mist could come in from there too, believe it or not. But anyway, I remember going to Calcutta and buying a lot of carpets, and shipping those home legitimately and paying the tax on them and selling some of them when I got home too. Gave them to my parents, some of them to my parents, and the Indian carpets, and some of them I sold at profit, quite a good profit too.
But what would you wear while you were flying?
Oh, almost just khaki drill. I did have, there was one aircraft which came down in the jungle, and I think the Karen rebels who'd expected to get, what shall we say, independence from Britain, got these chaps and shot them. And I went into Calcutta, where we did have our ordinary revolvers, and we had Sten guns in the back, incidentally. And there was still trouble going on. I mean, at Mingla Don, near Rangoon, there was gunfire at night, usually, as guerrillas would fire into the camp at night. And I thought I'd better have a little handgun. And I'm basically left-handed. And I had a left-handed holster made and bought a little pistol called a monoblock and put that in there. And once Indian police came in the plane and they saw this gun and said, "Is that a service weapon?" I said, "No, it isn't. It's caught at my own protection." They said, "We've got to take it off you." They took it off me. And I said, "Well, we've got Sten guns, but if we're going to crash, you know, I've got to go out quickly. I can't get at my Sten guns." But anyway, they took this monoblock thing off me. And then I was got back after the flight. I think we went to Hong Kong and back. And I was called up the provost marshal in Calcutta to account for the existence of this gun. I showed him my receipt certificate and told him the circumstance. He just gave it back to me and said, "That's it." So I think at that stage I was just about due for demobilisation. And I went to see the CO who laughed about it. And he said, "Well, let's have a look at this thing." I said, "Well, here it is. I'm going to chuck it away because I'm going back home." He said, "I'll buy it off you." he bought this little pistol off me, which I think I did fire it once to make sure it worked. But it was only a little tiny handgun, which I thought I would be useful because things were not quite as, especially in Burma and French Indochina. It was all right in Siam. It was all right in Hong Kong. But there were difficult circumstances in those other places, now Vietnam and what is now Burma.
Did you fly down to the Dutch East Indies at all?
No, we didn't go that far.
So at the end of your time, they'd asked you to stay on for 6 months. Was that just to tie things up, or was it because you were losing a lot of...
Well, my demobilisation came up soon after I arrived there. But I still wanted to look at these other places, and I was inquisitive about them, and I thought, well, I might as well do another 6 months since I've come all the way out here. Let me have a look at Hong Kong, let me have a look at Singapore, let me look at all these other places. I remember on one occasion we had to pick up the Princess Marlat of the Shan States. And this was at Mingla Don, I think. Or would it be Mike Tila? Anyway, this entourage of all these little girls came in. Now, this Princess Marlat had married an Australian chap called Bellamy. And they had a daughter who was probably about 18 or 19. She was the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen in all my life. She really was. She was part Shan States, which is not exactly Burmese, but up on the border near China. And I don't think they'd had much Japanese interference up there. But anyway, I said, invited this girl up to me. I remember we were flying over the Irrawaddy. All these little children were running about, and I said, what are they saying? And they said, well, they think there are fish in the water, and there were sampans going up and down the water. So I invited her into the crew compartment and got on very well with this girl, whose name was June Rose Bellamy, and said, where are you going? And she said, well, we've got to go up to... we're going to stay in Darjeeling at the Mount Everest Hotel. Oh, that's really interesting. So when we landed, I went to see my CEO. I got on extremely well with him. I said, look, I've been flying quite a bit here now. I really, honestly, I'd like a little bit of leave, if I may. He said, all right, well, you can go away at the end of the week and, you know, give you 8 days, 10 days off. I said, never had any leave, you see. So I got on a train and went up to Darjeeling, inquired there at the Mount Everest Hotel where this royal party was, and they said, well, they've gone off to Delhi. So I was sitting there looking, feeling miserable, and the clouds parted, and there was Kanchenjunga in front of me. So I thought, well, I know what I'll do. So I went out to some agency and said, look, I want to do a climbing expedition around Everest and Kanchenjunga. And they said, all right, well, so you need some Sherpas for that and, you know, carriers and so on, and you can go out for, I think it was 6 days, rough scrambling up to about 12,000 feet. So I did that and took photographs all the way and photographed Mount Everest and so on, photographed Kanchenjunga. Managed to write, linked up with an officer in the Gurkhas halfway through it, and we formed up a team together going over these foothills, I suppose you'd call them, up to about 12,000 feet. He was all nicely dressed with his pack all squared up, and I was not looking like an RAF officer. But anyway, he got very annoyed with me. He said, you go over this bloody hills like a mountain goat. He said, he can't keep up with you. So I did have an interesting time there, although I didn't meet June Rose Bellamy. I don't know what happened to her. But it was quite an interesting time.
Was there ever a question you'd be staying on in the RAF?
7 years, was it? What was it? The question
of... of staying on in the RAF?
Staying on the RAF. It did occur to me, but I wanted to go to university. I had a bit of a snag there, because you could only get a grant if you didn't have a job to go back to, and I had a job to go back to, and I couldn't lie about it, and so I had to go back to the to Lloyds Bank. Anyway, I thought, well, I have to do something about this, so I took a correspondence course in economics at night, in addition to furthering my bank examinations. And I passed that okay. And then I went to the London School of Economics. And to get in there, you had to pass an entrance examination. And I sat that and passed it all right. Then I went back to the authorities and said, look, I now have an entrance certificate to the London School of Economics. I have a matriculation in economics too. What about it? And they said, all right. So they gave me a grant to go to university, and that's what I did. And then on to postgrad.
Just one last question then, Roy. How do you feel now about having served with the RAF during the Second World War?
I'm quite proud of it, I think. I'm glad I did it. I look at it in another way, perhaps, that suppose I hadn't done it. Suppose I'd just been... wait until I was conscripted. I would have been ashamed of myself.